If you're hoping to change the world, the writer Mark Bittman says you can start by changing what you eat. Bittman wrote a book called Food Matters. Mixed in with the recipes in this book is an argument about how your diet can affect more than your health. He told Steve Inskeep the next time you pass on the cheeseburgers, you could help save the planet.
It's not that challenging. We all enjoy vegetarian meals from time to time. I'm just advocating that we enjoy more of them.
Here's why Mark Bittman is the latest author to argue for eating a little less meat. When you eat, say, a steak, somebody had to grow a cow, feed it for years, butcher it, transport it to market, all of which takes more energy than if you just ate some corn.
Beef happens to be the worst. There are fish that are not quite so offensive, farm-raised fish that are not quite so offensive. But it's also worth looking at environmental damage that's done by all, let's just say, industrial farming, from fish farming to chicken farming to, for that matter, egg and dairy farming. All has an environmental impact. And as someone said to me recently, every breath each of us takes has an environmental impact.
Well, if I just stopped breathing, the whole problem would go away.
Your carbon footprint shrinks proportionally to the amount that you're alive. So if you do go away, your carbon footprint goes to zero. But the fact is, there is environmental impact in every agricultural process. But for people who want to make a difference, you can take a quick look at these different processes and see that by eating fewer animal products, and by animal products, I mean all animal products, from dairy, eggs, fish, meat, etc., and more plants. And it's very much the Michael Pollan mantra, which is eat food, mostly plants. And my take on this is that proportionally, if you eat, say, 10 meals that include meat a week, which is not uncommon in the United States where people eat 200 pounds of meat a year, so a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Half a pound a day, more or less. If you eat a couple of meals less of meat each week, you're doing yourself, for a variety of health reasons, and the planet, for, in a smaller way, but a not insignificant way, if we all did it, obviously, you're doing all of us a favor.
The food writer Michael Pollan, he's been on this program more than once, and he's recently been in the news because he's been advocating different national policies having to do with food and saying that we can't really deal with problems like energy unless we deal with food. I get his arguments on a national level. I understand where he's coming from there. Are you arguing that individuals could make a significant difference, though?
I am arguing that individuals could make a significant difference. If the United States processes, which is a nice word for kills, 10 billion, billion animals each year. That is, we raise and slaughter 10 billion animals a year for consumption. 10% less is obviously 9 billion. That would have both an environmental impact and an impact on all of our mutual health.
Although people aren't going to want to do that 10% unless they're still getting a good meal, I suppose.
Well, there's nothing wrong with eating smaller amounts of meat. There's nothing wrong with eating meals that have no meat whatsoever. And, you know, in Food Matters, I give recipes for doing so. But I almost don't even want to say that. I want to say, look, it's quite common sense that you can eliminate animal products from some of your diet.
Mark Bittman, I see that you've divided some of the recipes in this book, Food Matters, by meal. And you've got a chapter here on different breakfasts. And I want you to sell me on a breakfast that fits your requirements, and you need to know in advance that I could eat breakfast 3 times a day. So how am I going to get a good breakfast that I like and still fit with your requirements?
I had for breakfast a bowl of oatmeal with maple syrup in it. So I, you know, and I was quite happy with that. Now, if you're not happy with that because it's not enough for you, or maybe 3 times a day would get to be a bit much for you, I would say at lunch you might have that same bowl of oatmeal with perhaps some, scallions and soy sauce on top, which would be very Asian but still pretty good.
Soy sauce oatmeal?
Oh, my God, it's great. And for dinner, I don't know, a poached egg on your oatmeal, since you're having oatmeal 3 times a day now. But seriously, I eat whole grains.
But I shouldn't be eating an egg, right? Because that's an animal product. You're saying I'd never have an egg, but I should eat less of them, you're saying.
Well, I would say you should not have an egg 7 times a week. Although if you wanted to have an egg 7 times a week, I would then argue that you don't have cheeseburgers 7 lunches a week. The general rule, though, is I probably eat 70% less in the animal kingdom than I did 2 or 3 years ago. But that's a much different diet than the way I used to eat, where I'd wake up in the morning and eat the kind of breakfasts you were just talking about, eggs and bacon and toast or pancakes or whatever, and then maybe have a sandwich with meat for lunch or a hamburger for lunch or, you know, pasta with meat or, you know, big carbohydrate lunch. Now it's really my in-day eating is really fruits and vegetables for the most part. And then at night I go back to eating kind of old style.
Was it hard for you to change your diet given that what's available is what's available, especially when you're out going to restaurants or trying to get a quick lunch or whatever else?
Well, there are challenges, but the rewards are incredible. So first let me speak about the challenges. The challenges are, as you say, what's available is not the ideal diet. But you can go out, and I've done this all over the world. You can go out to a store and buy yourself a bag of fruit or a bag of fruit and vegetables, if that's how you want to eat, and walk around snacking on that stuff all day. It's not the most sophisticated and satisfying diet, but it works. We're not going to see, as individuals, we're not going to see an impact we're having on the environment or on climate change, obviously. But for me, when I started eating the way I'm describing, I lost 35 pounds, which was about 15% of my body weight. My cholesterol went down 40 points. My blood sugar went from borderline bad to just fine. My knees, which were starting to give out as a result of running at too high a weight, got better. And I had sleep apnea, which one doctor suggested was a result of being overweight, and that went away. So all of those things happened within a few months, and that's some serious positive reinforcement there.
That and feeling like you're changing the world.
Well, feeling like you're changing the world. Yeah, that's a nice thing, too.
Mark Mittman, thanks very much.
It's been great to talk with you.
His new book is called Food Matters, A Guide to Conscious Eating.
And we've got an excerpt from Food Matters and a recipe for Mark Mittman's breakfast bread pudding at NPR.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News with Steve Inskeep. I'm Renee Montagne.
Scientists who study global warming are especially interested in Antarctica. That's because the melting of Antarctic ice could obliterate coastlines around the globe. The continent's peninsula, that juts toward South America, has been warming rapidly. But scientists have been puzzled in the past by findings that the rest of the continent seemed to be getting cooler. Well, now a study suggests that large parts of Antarctica have in fact been heating up, as NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Antarctica is so remote, scientists didn't even put permanent weather stations there until 1957, and even those were in just a few scattered places. Eric Steig at the University of Washington says that made it hard to take the continent's temperature.
I like to say it's a little bit like having data in San Francisco and New York and trying to say something about Arizona. You really need some more information if you're going to say anything reasonable about Arizona.
Steig and his colleagues have done just that for Antarctica, taking the sparse temperature records of the past 50 years and combining them with satellite records that cover a much greater area but don't go so far back in time. The result, as they now report in the journal Nature, is that a big chunk of Antarctica, the western part of the continent, has in fact been warming up like the rest of the world, where temperatures have risen by about a degree near the equator to more than 5 degrees near the North Pole.
It's much less than Arctic warming, but it is pretty much on par with global average warming.
Now, Steig says warming isn't necessarily all bad news. Up to a point, Antarctic warming can actually reduce sea level. Warming can take water out of the ocean through evaporation and deposit it on the continent in the form of increased snowfall.
West Antarctica should be getting more precipitation along with this increased temperature. But I think the data to demonstrate that are not really available.
In fact, the best data from Antarctica show that the continent is putting slightly more water into the ocean than it's taking out. Now, the fact that Antarctica is in fact warming up is reassuring in a way to Arctic scientist Richard Alley at Penn State University.
The world looks a little more sensible to me than it did before.
Scientists expect that Antarctica should be heating up according to what they understand about global warming. And the consequence of warming Antarctic air is not cause for panic, Alley says.
for now, most of the Antarctic is still so cold that it's very hard to melt it from above. The big question for Antarctica for the near future is what happens to the ocean, because the warm ocean waters can circulate under the floating extensions of the Antarctic, the ice shelves.
And if warmer water melts those ice shelves, they'll release mountains of ice behind them into the ocean. Scientists have already seen the consequences of that along the relatively warm Antarctic Peninsula. There, at least 8 large ice shelves have melted away in recent decades. David Vaughan from the British Antarctic Survey is on the peninsula right now, keeping a close eye on the Wilkins ice sheet, which was once larger than Connecticut, but could soon be gone entirely.
We landed on that ice shelf just 2 days ago, flimsy-looking piece of ice, and that appears to be hanging on by the skin of its teeth.
It could collapse in the next few weeks, he says.
Not all of Wilkins will disappear overnight, but a large part of it could.
That ice sheet is already floating on the ocean, so when it melts, it won't raise sea level. But it's a powerful reminder that change can come quickly and dramatically in this land of ice. Richard Harris, NPR News.
There's a mystery in California over what's causing the sickness and death of hundreds of brown pelicans. Yesterday, the California Department of Fish and Game released a preliminary report suggesting that the cold snap in the Pacific Northwest might be part of the problem. More tests are pending. In the meantime, wildlife rescuers are trying to save the remaining birds, as Gloria Hillard reports.
This fishing pier is a popular hangout for California brown pelicans. About a dozen of the long-necked birds are perched here. As wildlife rescuers Dave Wieshoff and Bob Beckler approach the feathered assemblage, the birds gently take to the air. Wieshoff and Beckler are here for the ones that are sick and unable to fly.
Dave?
Yeah.
Let's get this guy.
Okay. Do we need the net?
Maybe.
Another bird is in trouble.
He's a little weak.
This one is in the water.
You got him?
Wieshoff drapes a small white sheet over the bird to calm him. In his arms, it looks as if he's holding a small child in a makeshift Halloween ghost costume. Gently, the bird is folded into a carrier.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah.
Okay.
Here, baby.
Okay.
Great. He ate a couple pieces before I caught him. I don't think that's enough.
Well, okay, we'll get it. We'll get him hydrated.
At the International Bird Rescue and Research Center in San Pedro, they've taken in more than 45 ailing pelicans in the last 2 weeks. Rehabilitation manager Julie King and her staff have been working around the clock trying to save them.
To see what we're seeing now is very out of the ordinary.
In previous years, the endangered pelicans have been plagued with domoic acid poisoning, a neurotoxin found in algae blooms, King says.
Generally, birds that come in with domoic acid poisoning have some fairly severe neurological symptoms, and none of the birds that we've been seeing necessarily exhibit any of those symptoms other than the general disorientation.
Initial blood and tissue tests have shown trace amounts of domoic acid, but researchers believe it may be playing a secondary role to a larger problem. What that is, they don't know yet. Hundreds of birds from Baja to Washington State have been found dead or sick far from their coastal home, including a pelican found wandering in the snow at an elevation of 7,000 feet in New Mexico. The federal government wants to remove the bird from the endangered species list, but wildlife rescuers on the ground say that's a mistake. Longtime volunteer Dave Wieshoff says the majestic bird has not had an easy go of it.
Every day we see fishhooks. Almost every day we see gunshots, pellet guns, BB guns, that sort of thing, monofilament fishing line. So there's just a lot of different pressures on these birds in terms of being able to survive out in the wild.
For now, the 24 or so pelicans rehabilitating in the center's large aviary and water pool are the lucky ones. These birds, King says, are showing signs of improvement.
Yeah, that we'll actually be able to release all the ones that we have is definitely our biggest hope. And also that we're releasing them into a safe environment.
Which is not necessarily the case.
Right. So I think we'll definitely be taking them. Our main goal is to do what we can for them as quickly as we can and get them back out into the environment.
Even with all its perils. For NPR News, I'm Gloria Hillard.
Throughout his term, President George W. Bush has worked to preserve coal's preeminence as the biggest source of electricity and to increase domestic production of oil and natural gas. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports these priorities translated into a lasting environmental legacy.
One of the best places to contemplate the impact of the Bush administration's environmental policies is from Larry Gibson's mountain in southern West Virginia.
Let me show you something if you turn around and look. You see that point over yonder and this point way over here? It went up like this, like a camel's back.
Gibson grew up here, and so did many of his ancestors. It used to be that if you stood at the edge of his property, all you'd see was Caford Mountain.
You could not see past this mountain because this was the highest.
It was 3,200 feet high at some points. Now Gibson is standing at 2,400 feet, looking down.
And this here is what hell looks like to me on Earth.
What used to be a peak is now a massive mining site. A coal company scraped off the top of the mountain to get to coal seams. Across Appalachia, similar operations are flattening mountains and covering up streams. The Bush administration has promoted what is called mountaintop removal mining and even changed environmental rules when lawsuits threatened to halt the practice. Last summer, President Bush told the West Virginia Coal Association that coal is the most reliable source of electricity.
Coal is affordable, and coal is available right here in the United States of America.
Truly, I think that the Bush administration is responsible for the destruction of one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world.
Joe Lovett is a West Virginia lawyer who has argued most of the lawsuits to end mountaintop mining.
And if you fly over the mountains, what you see is a wasteland where once there were the most productive and diverse temperate hardwood forests in the world, mountain streams, those are gone.
I don't agree with that.
Bill Rainey is the executive director of the West Virginia Coal Association.
They want everyone to believe that, you know, every mountaintop is going to be mined, and that simply is not true.
One of the rule changes that bolstered mountaintop mining was signed by Christine Todd Whitman, President Bush's first Environmental Protection Agency chief.
Mountaintop mining is, frankly, to my mind, ugly. On the other hand, it is the sole way of earning a living for many, many people down there.
Whitman says lots of people don't like coal, but other energy options also have downsides. Half of the nation's electricity comes from coal. She says that's why a lot of Bush administration environmental decisions were made to help the mining companies and utilities that make electricity from coal. For instance, President Bush reversed a campaign pledge and decided not to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. He also made it easier for older coal-fired power plants to avoid installing pollution control devices.
And that was too bad. That was a loss for all of us, frankly.
Whitman says she couldn't sign off on that one. It's part of why she quit. But she says President Bush's environmental legacy is misunderstood.
What you hear is a lot of the negatives, and there were a lot of negatives. But there are also good things that were done, and people tend to forget that, and we shouldn't.
Whitman points to decisions to slash cancer-causing pollution from diesel trucks and buses and preserve huge stretches of the Pacific as marine national monuments. But environmentalists say that's not what people will remember. Marty Hayden of the environmental law group Earth Justice says the president's legacy will be opening treasured landscapes for timber harvests and oil and gas development.
And we're talking about places like the Canyon of the Ancients National Monument in Colorado, areas across the Red Rock region of Utah, and they've leased millions of acres of the polar bear seas right out from under the polar bear.
Contrary to what some believe, this is not the administration of just drill, drill, drill at all costs and do nothing else and ignore the environment.
Lawyer Michael Olson was an undersecretary of Interior. He says the president's actions are explained by his desire to make America less dependent on foreign oil at a time when competition for limited resources is increasing. And Olson says whether you're talking about mountaintop mining or drilling for oil offshore, these are tough issues. And they will challenge the next president as well. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
As members of Congress and the new administration work on developing renewable energy, they'll have a number of states to turn to for advice. More than half the states already require utilities to get a percentage of their electricity from renewable resources. And NPR's Jeff Brady has five lessons learned from one state, Colorado.
Even before he was director of the governor's energy office in Colorado, Tom Plant was a big fan of wind turbines and solar panels. As a state legislator, he tried to get his colleagues to pass a renewable energy requirement, but failed. Plant was pleased when in 2004, voters sidestepped the legislature and passed a law on their own.
The arguments that we heard against the amendment when it was being run are the same ones that we hear at the national level. It'll cost too much. It'll disrupt our electrical supply, blah, 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 all those sorts of things.
The state's largest utility, Xcel Energy, led that opposition. But then something interesting happened. After the law passed, Xcel found it was meeting the 10% target well ahead of schedule. A few years later, the utility actually supported a bill doubling the requirement. That's lesson number one from Colorado. Renewable energy advocates say the initial target should be pretty aggressive because it's likely utilities will find a way to meet it. Now we're on to lesson two. The requirement should be somewhat flexible. This is especially important to Frank Prager. He's Xcel Energy's vice president of environmental policy. He says a utility needs to find ways to use renewable sources of energy and still be profitable, all the while keeping rates reasonable. Prager says flexibility will be very important in the Southeast, where they don't have as many renewable energy options as Colorado.
We're situated in a really great part of the nation for purposes of wind, for example, because we've got the best wind in the nation right in our backyard. It's sort of wind alley across our entire system.
Xcel has become the nation's largest wind energy provider in the last few years, and for that reason, Prager has another piece of advice for policymakers.
It's going to be very important, and from our perspective, this is extremely important, to make sure that you get credit for what you've already done.
Now, this is a sticking point between utilities and renewable energy advocates, but Prager says early adopters like Xcel shouldn't be penalized for being ahead of the curve. Issues like that and whether hydropower dams should be considered renewable resources likely will get plenty of debate in Congress. The original backers of Colorado's law have a fourth piece of advice. This is directed at their national colleagues. Bring new allies to the negotiating table. They found it valuable to woo the business community. Keith Hay with Environment Colorado says his group commissioned reports touting the economic benefits of renewable energy.
We can take those kind of reports and say to people, look, we get the environmental benefits. That's important to us. But here's what you care about. And here's the benefit to you on those grounds. That's a really significant step that we as the environmental community here in Colorado took. And at the national level, it's absolutely a step we'll need to take.
Finally, there's an issue that everyone interviewed for this story agrees on, but it's almost always an afterthought: electricity transmission. Most of the poles and wires in the U.S. today were built to service traditional power plants, not the vast open spaces where wind and solar energy are abundant. If renewable energy is going to work in the U.S., advocates say, you need a way to get it from the source to where people live. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.